What would European expeditions of the American continent have looked like with women at the helm? A satirical play at the Unicorn Theater puts 10 manly explorers on 4 boats in the Grand Canyon for some macho 19th century adventuring. But the cast is all female. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're catching up with the director, Missy Koontz. Hi, Missy.
Hey, Gina.
Give me your synopsis of Men on Boats.
Well, we've got Major John Wesley Powell, who was a big officer in the Civil War and had many great conquests there. And he and 9 brave and adventurous explorers went off to explore the Green and Colorado Rivers through the Grand Canyon. And so it's a true-ish tale of their adventures and...
And the date is 1869?
Yes. Yes. It started on May 24th, 1869. They started out on their journey.
This play has been performed by some theater companies around the country, and I've read reviews of those performances. It seems like it's getting great reviews. What this premise doesn't sound like it would just automatically spell like brilliance and humor. It seems like there's something in the execution that makes it shine. Can you put your finger on what that is?
Well, I think really a lot of it has to do with Jacqueline Bacchus' writing of it. She wrote it in such a way that there is a rhythm to the actual writing, and it's almost in so many spaces a prose or written in sort of a poetry sonnet-esque or something along those lines. But in that vein, when upon first read, you're wondering, what the heck is happening here? And then you read it again, and then you hear it out loud when you sit down at the table with the actors and we read through it for the first time. And it's really so incredibly very funny and clever and written in a modern vernacular. So there's nothing about what we do that really could even come close to the actual expedition, the way that it's executed.
Talk about that a little. So you've got performers who are supposed to be on boats in the Grand Canyon when they are on a stage in Midtown Kansas City, which yeah, seems hard to pull off convincingly. Is convincingly the goal?
Well, I think that we have to suspend our realities and really rely on our imaginations to some extent, but we do have a great set design, and we're going to have some beautiful lights. We have originally composed music that's underscoring all of the boat scenes and the transitions.
But how do you make, how do you make the boats in the water?
Right. Well, we have projections that come straight down onto the stage that are swirling images, and the stage is painted in such a way that we have different colors of the rocks under the water and the blues. And so it can be water or land, depending on how it's lit and what it is that we're doing. We have boats that have no bottoms and have no backs, and they have handles, so we can set them down and act while standing up in them, or we can hold them and have different action as though we're on the water. And a lot of it just has to do with how creative can we all be as a team. When we came together, I said, myself and producing artistic director Cynthia Levin, what can we do, creatively to kind of pull this off? And you really have to use a lot of imagination and have a great team of people to make that happen.
The title of the play being Men on Boats seems like it's kind of tapping into this whole idea in the American imagination. And I wonder what is it that makes it that an idea that's so interesting to explore with women in the roles of those men?
Well, I'll start it out by just saying a quote from Jacqueline Bacchus in an interview where she said that it's interesting to me to take the idea of male conquest, give it to someone who usually doesn't have that right, and sort of put that into the roles themselves. It begs the question, what histories are we lacking? So that was her sort of idea when she went in to the writing of it. And then there are stage directions within the script that say, in talking about the casting, you know, really go for gender fluidity, for cisgender, for transgender, for non-specific gender qualities, and that's actually built into the writing and the structure of the play. It was originally directed by an openly trans director, Will Davis, and I think that there is a lot of that original production that made its way into this script.
Such as?
I think definitely probably the gender fluidity and the cisgender, the gender neutrality of it. I don't know that that was maybe originally so much of a part of it before Will directed it twice, once in New York off Broadway, and then in Chicago, where he's the artistic director of the American Theater. So I think that, you know, any time that you are a part of a world premiere, as I've directed world premieres before, is that you sort of get to leave a little bit of your mark on that original script when it's taken away and goes to other places, that through the stage directions and through maybe some of the rewrites and some of the flavor when it comes to you, that mark has been left by those that came before.
Tell me a little bit about some of the main characters and the qualities that they demonstrate on this adventure, on, you know, this sort of iconic type of adventure to dominate the American wilderness.
Well, we've got Vanessa Severo in the title role of John Wesley Powell, and he's a bit of a boisterous and definitely confident, to the point of overconfidence. He has lost one of his arms in the Civil War, so we have also an actor who is only using one arm while navigating boats with handles and crawling up mountain rock walls and doing quite a brilliant job of it, by the way. And then sort of juxtaposed to him, as through the rehearsal process, I've called them men and by their stage names to sort of kind of keep that moving along. We have Jessalyn Kincaid, who plays William Dunn, which is sort of the yin to Powell's yang. And also,
in what way?
More subdued, maybe more responsible, more focused on the exploration itself. Maybe not quite such a risk taker, although a very much a valid explorer in his own right. But looking to the safety of the people above and beyond the adventure, where Powell would go for, let's rush these rapids, and no matter how dangerous it is, so that we can get to where it is that we're going and discover one more thing, Dunn might say, well, you know, I think it might be safer if we portage the boats and we go by land. No, we won't know if we're going to make it until we make it, Powell would say.
Do you think that these characters come across differently in any important way because they are played by women than if they had been played by men?
Yeah, I think there's something really interesting about the modern vernacular being in there, that we're not going any sort of period speak, but just really modern day, and to see them, you know, what we really wanted to focus on in rehearsal was, who are the people? Who are they as people, as opposed to who are they as men? So to see where that might, where those sensibilities might come in, where we might, I don't think that we see necessarily a softer side. I think it's just a different side. It's a different way to look at things. And I guess when I watch it, I don't think of it as women playing men. I don't think of it that way. When I watch them up there, no matter what they've come to rehearsal wearing, they're just these people.
Does that make you see the idea of the pioneers and the explorers? Does it make you think about that chapter in history differently?
I guess I would wonder, it certainly does bring up and put you in a position to pose the question, what would it have been like had we had more women explorers? How would that have been different? Would they have taken a different journey? Would they have taken the journey differently? I don't know. But it is what it does do is sort of put you in a position to wonder, to question. And along the way, it's really, really funny. So that's certainly helpful as well.
There's also race fluidity in the casting. And when you think about the idea of the American continent having been first discovered by the explorers, that is a very racially charged idea.
Absolutely. I mean, not only was it male, but it was white male driven. So, you know, we did a little bit of a peek at the play at the Unicorn, and it was a group of people, 30, 40 people came in and watched a little bit of the rehearsal. And we have three, I would say, African-American, they're Nigerian. Actually, all three of the women of color in the show are Nigerian, which is really interesting in and of itself. But one of the men at the talkback said, well, was that, is that accurate? Were there slaves on this journey? And I thought that was really interesting that the question wasn't, were there people of color on the journey, but were there slaves? Just assuming in this time period, if there were people of color, they would have been slaves. And the answer, of course, was no. We just do, we do not only gender fluidity, but race fluidity as well. And that puts an interesting twist on it.
You have a long history of doing gender fluid casting on stage in Kansas City. Can you take me back through? I mean, this seems sort of in keeping with a lot of the way people talk about gender now. But that has not been the case throughout your career doing this.
That is correct. I was one of the co-founders of Late Night Theater long, long ago. We started doing shows even before being called Late Night Theater. Ron McGee and myself and a band of gypsies. And did that right off the bat. You know, it sort of started with we're all a little bit weird, and we're young, and we're wanting to. Well, you know, no one will cast us, and we want to do weird and crazy stuff. So we're going to start this theater company and do.
Wait, why would nobody cast you?
We were, you know, young and sort of wild and kind of a character actors in a day when there were no parts really written for young character actors. You either had to be an ingenue or you had to be an older. I remember one of my professors in college saying to me when I was 18, 19 years old, saying, well, you really won't work until you're 35. When I was 18 or 19 years old, I mean, can you imagine somebody that, you know, who's the person that's helping you to build your career saying, you're really not going to work until you're about 35?
I mean, setting the bar low takes a lot of pressure off in a way.
Well, it's also, you know, I sort of retired from acting at 35 and opened Bar Natasha. So I'd had a pretty long career self-made by things such as late night theater. And Ron writing those shows where we said, you know, we want to do this. And he was very inspired by Charles Bush. And then that sort of inspired me to in coterie shows or in different shows.
For children, saying,
well, you know, we're only going to cast 5 people. We're not going to cast 10 people. And everybody is going to play all of the roles. And it doesn't matter what color you are. And it doesn't matter what gender you are. We're just going to play these people.
Have audiences reacted differently to that over time?
I think that probably in the 90s, when this all began, that there was, you know, it was more of a camp situation. It was more of a niche and something odd and interesting. And maybe I don't know if I like that or not. And now, you know, it's just so very accepted, and not only accepted, but kind of loved and revered and held up, and I think more importantly, enjoyed, or it's not noticed at all.
Yeah, that last one. Do kids notice it?
No, they've always been, I think, the more accepting of it. It never mattered to them if the boy had on the dress or the girl had on the pants. You know, I think children are taught to worry about those things when they're children before someone told them that that's weird or bad or something like that, they don't know the difference. They don't care if their friend is a boy or a girl. They don't care what their friend is wearing until they learn from television or social media or their parents that they're supposed to.
So when you mentioned that when you first got the script for Men on Boats, that over the course of spending time with it, you went from like, what is going on here to, oh my God, this is really funny. Can you take me to a scene that really captures that, oh my God, this is really funny? I know you don't want to probably spoil too much, but just one little moment to give us a taste.
There are several moments in the show that I love, but the first scene that we have on land is we have Dunn and Powell and Sumner, and they're all in the Emma Dean, the boat named after my wife, says Powell, and just the rhythm of it, you hear them saying, they're wanting to name this mountain. Do you have any ideas? I have a few ideas. You have any ideas? I have some ideas. Do you have any ideas, Sumner? No. So you have a few ideas, and I have a few ideas, and we have a few ideas, and so...
So everyone's sort of staking a claim on having good ideas without actually revealing what they are.
Right, right, exactly. And then we go into sort of some of the names of it. But it's really the rhythm of the writing is where you find the comedy, because whether people know it or not, comedy comes from beats. Where those beats are, where the joke lands, the timing of it.
And yeah, they call it comic timing
for a reason. They do indeed. They do indeed. So, yeah. So she has really set you up to succeed in just sort of writing those beats in a lot of ways.
Missy Koontz is the director of Men on Boats, September 6th through October 1st at the Unicorn Theater. Thanks so much, Missy.
Thanks, Gina, for having me.
Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, Quixotic. Hear what it takes to choreograph and perform dance routines with the dancers hanging off the side of the Block building. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm sitting here now with Anthony Magliano, the creative director for Quixotic. If you've seen dancers doing amazing things while dangling from the sky against a backdrop of crazy lights and shadows, you have seen Quixotic. The group is a mainstay in Kansas City's art scene now, but when they started in 1994, they were a little-known group of dancers gone rogue, and we're going to hear that story. Anthony, good morning.
Hey there.
So 1994, I was pretty surprised to hear that was the genesis. I first encountered you guys in the early 2000s, and you still seemed more on the rogue side.
Right. Well, we definitely, you know, have a history of, you know, going into abandoned warehouses and art museums, art galleries, excuse me. And that's kind of our, you know, original kind of interest, was doing site-specific installations and kind of really changing up the experience to be a non-traditional environment.
So when you say we, who are you talking about?
I would say the core creative team, the other co-director in the group, Micah Thomas, Shane Borth, who's our lead composer, violinist, violist, Rachel Coates, who's been a dancer with us for quite a long time. So, and then now we have like close to 30 performers, Kansas City based and then beyond as well.
What's your background?
Well, my background is actually graphic design and music, but I've also dabbled in a lot of animation and film and video photography.
So, I mean, this is known as a dance troupe, Quixotic is, but it's such a collaborative across the board organization.
Mm-hmm.
That is, would you call that unusual in Kansas City?
Yeah, I would say so. And I think that it's just by the, you know, our approach is to integrate different artists that normally don't work together to come up with new inventive processes to create, you know, works of art. And yeah, I think it's, you know, we've really been lucky to come across some really passionate people that bring a lot of different diverse talents. And a lot of people know what we like to do, and it kind of attracts those same people. And then that's kind of how we've grown into what we do.
Take me back to 1994. I mean, just where the spark for this idea came from.
To be honest with you, you know, Shane Borth, the violinist, composer, and Quixotic that has helped me create a lot of the music, You know, we have played in a lot of bands, and we were just wanting to do something different with our music. I think we were just wanting to explore new end results of the hard work of our music. And, you know, we wanted to explore the theatrical world, and we had a lot of friends in the dance community. And we had been talking to a lot of the Kansas City Ballet dancers in their off season, and they were wanting to connect with us about, oh, well, why don't we do something, you know, because we have this time off, why don't we do something different? And we were also working with Charlotte Street Foundation back in the early days, and they were doing a lot of really cool stuff with some of their art spaces, like the Boley Building.
Yeah, buildings that had been standing empty for a long time. Charlotte Street was moving in and kind of, I think the language would be activating those spaces.
Correct.
But the idea being that nothing had been happening there, and just putting bodies in there doing something.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how we started out. And it was a good opportunity. I had a really great, you know, career doing advertising and design, and was having a lot of fun with that. But this was kind of my outside of work creative project. And it was great because I was getting to work with a lot of other artists, again, that, you know, whether it was a dancer or a composer or a sculptor, and all of us were working together for one common goal, to create a emotional piece of work through performance art in cool spaces that people normally wouldn't go to or didn't know about or, you know, would change around.
With graphic design, that's what you said your background was. It must have been interesting to start working with the human body as your material, in a way. The human body against a physical setting, as opposed to perhaps like type against a screen or against a paper.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right. Well, I think that, you know, the way I look at, you know, creating performances, experiences, is, you know, whether the canvas is a stage or, you know, a building or a wall or whatever it is, it's kind of like you're painting with movement, and you're painting with light, and you're painting with sound, and or designing or doing a layout, because it's a lot of the same principles, you know, balance and symmetry and contrast. And And also in writing a piece of music, you have your intro, climax, conclusion. So a lot of the same principles apply. The way we work is it's really great to bring in different choreographers, and then we kind of put our heads together from our both of our backgrounds, and then we have the composition and costume and everything else, and then it just becomes a whole what it is.
The choreographers, are a lot of them, I've gotten the impression that a lot of them are dancers who primarily work with other people's choreography a lot of the time, and then have this opportunity to kind of bring their own creative spark to the movement.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, we have some, you know, like we're working with, for this event we have coming up here at the Nelson Atkins, we're working with Ryan Nye, who was with Kansas City Ballet for a while. He's an incredible up-and-coming choreographer. He's been doing some great work for Kansas City Dance Festival that premiered at the Folly. His work's amazing. But we're also working with Andrea Shermily, who's based out of LA now, but she comes back and does work with us, and she had a great career with NDT. We work with Robert Deckers, who's has a company called Post Ballet. But then, you know, we also have our performers within Quixotic. A lot of the processes, again, being collaborative, a lot of times we'll create pieces where they'll work together to you know, develop the works and the process. So it just depends on what we're doing and, you know, who's available.
It's not often, though, that like a grassroots arts collaboration like this would kind of, I don't know, take on the level of acclaim that you guys have. Like, really, you have a pretty broad mainstream audience recognition here in Kansas City, like kind of inching up towards some of those big players in town, the big dance companies, the big music groups, the big theaters. You don't have a physical home that you're attached to. And it was, yeah, really just a group of people who wanted to do something different. Is it surprising to you? Because it's kind of been surprising to me.
Yeah, it is, actually. I mean, I had no idea this was going to be my second career. You know, I was, you know, had a great career again in advertising, and I was an interactive creative director, and I loved that. I had a great team doing that. And then this kind of, you know, we started doing some more and more things out of town as well, and then it started growing and blossoming into what it is today. And I had no idea. It was not planned at all. But, you know, I'm really excited to where it's been and, you know, and how many people it's touched and inspired. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, my business partner and I, when we look at what we've created, we see a lot of people that are Kansas City artists that are, they're making their living doing this now. And they're, you know, we're out there representing Kansas City for this unique performance art that we've created. It makes us really, you know, excited to keep going. And that's what kind of drives the whole, you know, project further and forward. So,
an aspect of a lot of the dance components, I mean, there is a lot of hanging from the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, on top of the artists and, you know, the performers, we also have an incredible technical staff that's been with us for a long time, like Matt Bennett, Tommy Hester. These guys are really dedicated to the behind the scenes, figuring out the engineering, the rigging, the all the logistics of how we're going to do that safely, and then also using inventive ways to, you know, create that. Like when we, you know, do the vertical dancing and the wall dancing on different spaces, you know, that's definitely, it's the art and science coming together.
As not a dancer yourself, do you remember the first time you saw these human bodies, like, lifting up and becoming, like, unbound by gravity in this particular way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, you know, inspired by groups like Momix and Palabolas and a lot of those groups back, you know, being exposed to checking out stuff that has come to Kansas City.
Long-time dance troupes, uh-huh, not based here.
Correct, that would come through and just being inspired what they're doing, you know, what they're doing. And then, you know, at the time when Quixotic started, you know, it was very much, you know, we really wanted to do something that was complementary to the arts community and the art scene here and not do something that was already happening, but like really be our own and complement all the other great things that are going on here to almost expand the community and the diversity of the types of art Kansas City offers.
So these early shows were in places like, you know, West Bottoms Warehouse spaces, artsy get-togethers with not necessarily like giant turnout. Mm-hmm. And now you are the called upon group to do the block building 10th anniversary outdoors, you know, a performance that accentuates that architecture. Tell me about that upcoming performance.
Well, we're super excited. We actually really enjoy doing a couple large-scale shows a year still in Kansas City. You know, we tour and travel so much, but one of our missions and goals is to do one big community show a year that's free to the public, and this one actually worked out perfectly in line with, you know, the time of year, and it's the 10th year of the block building, and it couldn't be a more perfect, you know, opportunity and an honor. And, you know, we've done some work at the Nelson before on the south side of the lawn where we've done some wall dancing and projection mapping, but every year we keep getting better.
What is projection mapping?
Projection mapping is using digital light from a projector, and we do animation on architecture. And sometimes, like what we've actually done with the Union Station, we told the story of the 100-year centennial for them, using their architecture to tell their story. With this, we're going to be doing the architectural mapping to kind of pay tribute to Steve Holt, architect of the Black Building, and kind of a tribute to the incredible architecture he put together there.
So is there something that you visually latched onto as far as the block building itself or the ground surrounding it that you worked to accentuate?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time, you know, and we being, you know, some of the other guys on my animation team and some of the other girls with the dancers, we all kind of spent time to really feel, you know, the vibe of what it is inside the building, outside. And Amica, and I, my business partner, we had gone and done a lot of tours inside. We actually got in between the lenses and just really...
The lenses, like what people might see as, right, like ice cubes or something.
Correct.
Like that, like each separate
mm-hmm.
box.
Correct. And I mean, we're just, you know, I'm intrigued with the interior architecture and design as much as the outside. Because there's, I mean, it's like there's no bad angle picture. I mean, every you put your phone out and you start taking pictures, it's like there's so much cool angular and just beautiful symmetry in there. And so we were very intrigued by the interior as well as the art or the outside. So what we're putting together and working with our animation team is we're going to have it to where you can see inside the building from outside. So the audience will be able to see almost like that X-ray effect. So you'll be able to see. And then a lot of the stuff.
Wait, how did you do that?
Just through 3D animation processes. You know, we took some of the CAD drawings and then just, you know, kind of using 3D software, we kind of rendered out the interiors. And then once you have that created in the computer and CG, then you're able to manipulate it. And then
so
that's
you're
where
projecting
we
the inside of the building onto the outside of the building?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
So almost as if you can see inside. On moments of, but we're also, you know, the way we broke down the projection mapping experience is very much a tribute, you know, but then it also goes into using the architecture itself as a unique in what I call like a surreal canvas experience. So we're kind of like creating our own contemporary light art on top of the building as a canvas.
So with the building as a canvas, what can you tell me anything about the dance or the other aspects right. of it that will happen?
Well, so we're actually doing the wall dance or the vertical dance on the other building in contrast. So that way
on the 1930s building?
Correct. And, you know, we're using that in contrast because what we're trying to do is create, you know, and that's when we do these site-specific installations, I think part of it is, you know, figuring out, okay, how many people are going to be here and where are the sight lines and we want to be able to create experiences in multiple spaces so that everybody feels like they're, oh, I was really close to this when this happened. And then if you're standing here.
So there's like kind of an you know, I was here aspect.
Correct. And then, so that's kind of what we thought would work out better to have. So, it, you know, and that part of the, we're actually going to, I believe, start our evening with that as of right now. The set was going to start with the, you know, where it started, and then we'll eventually end up over at the block building. So,
I mean, I'm assuming that you had been to the Nelson Atkins plenty of times before planning this show. But is there something that you have noticed about it that you didn't notice before working on this?
I think with, you know, being on this other side or putting this production together, you know, the water so beautiful, and we're really trying to work that into this. With the way we're setting light up and even the way we're setting the stage. And it's just such a you know, picture perfect, you know, image for us to create, or canvas, site specific art canvas for us to create performance art on top, you know. And, you know, I think, you know, the water, the way the contrast of the buildings, the illuminated building, it's all very.
Anthony Magliano, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Quixotic will perform against the side of the Block Building to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the landmark at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. That show is next Friday, a week from today, so head to the Nelson's website for more information. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're listening to a big hit song from a local band called The Fantastics, with a PH. It's called Bananas, and it kind of captures the mission and vision of the band, which is to make them go bananas on the dance floor. And there are lots of opportunities to do that because The Fantastics have 4 live shows this month. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Kemet Coleman is with us. He's the rapper from the band. Hi, Kemet.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe The Fantastics?
The Fantastics are a dance band on a high level. Beneath that, we are a intergenerational, interdisciplinary musical ensemble with various different backgrounds and with the ultimate goal of creating a new experience for live music and getting people on the dance floor.
We might be able to hear what you're saying a little more clearly when we listen to another clip, because people might have just been like getting down to bananas, but I do feel like we should let them know that later in the song, there are all these different parts that sound in many ways nothing alike. So can we listen real quick?
Yeah, sure.
So this is later in that same song we were just hearing. That's some serious metal. And, I mean, it actually gets even crazier with different genres happening all at once later on.
Yes. Yeah, we definitely try to incorporate as many genres as possible to create not chaos, but a winding river of music, basically.
What's your background musically?
My background is in gospel and rap and R&B. I was pretty much forced to do music by my mother, who forced me to play the piano, and I resented it until I started making music on my own and becoming a beat maker.
The resenting piano lessons is a familiar story.
Yes, I never wanted to practice, but I was forced to.
And you grew up on gospel and R&B?
Definitely, yeah. My father actually was an AME preacher, African Methodist Episcopal, and my mother was Baptist and pretty fundamental Baptist, so gospel was definitely a huge part of my upbringing. And my brothers were obviously into rap music, being 80s babies, and they're like 10 and 11 years older than I am. So I was ultra exposed to different genres of the Black experience, basically.
Do you think that the Black experience is an important part of what you're bringing to this music?
Yes, I think so, at least. Just the spirit of improvisation, which is rooted, you know, going back to jazz music, to gospel, to spirituals. And I think that is a huge part of music in general, especially America's contribution to the musical lexicon.
So the collaboration with people coming from all different backgrounds, tell me a little bit more about the different backgrounds people are bringing to this band. How many members are there in the Fantastics?
There are technically 9 of us. Our trumpet player is also a player on cruise ships. He has kind of a funk background. The core of the band is what I consider the drummer, whose name is Ashley, the guitar player, and the bass player. And those three had a band called Stone Deaf, which was a prog rock band prior to us. And they dabbled heavily in jam band type of styles. And so
that makes so much sense with the winding river of sound that you were just describing, where it sounds one way and then you're like, this is the same song and it's still going for a while, but it doesn't actually sound like the beginning.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, there's metal. There's got our drummer's basically a church drummer. Our guitarist he majored in guitar in college. And so we've got all these different genres that are just kind of mashed up together.
Tell me about the metal, because metal and gospel are two sounds that I never really expected to hear blended into one.
Is it?
Ever.
Is it? I mean, I don't know. I think they're kind of similar in a lot of ways, primarily just the energy and the ability to lose yourself in the music on both of those genres are pretty similar, in my opinion. And so I think it's definitely on opposite end of the experiential spectrum, but I
or
think
maybe just I don't know, expectations about who's listening.
Yeah, with different audience for sure. I can agree with you there.
You are also an urbanist, which I bring up because that's a part of your music, at least as a solo artist.
Yes.
Tell me about, first of all, your background. What makes you an urbanist?
I think it first and foremost probably started from the social justice piece that I'm pretty much has been instilled in me from my mother and father. My father being, like I said, a AME preacher, African Methodist Episcopal, and
here in Kansas City.
In Kansas City, yeah, and was also a civil rights attorney. In Kansas City. And so I saw all these clients of his that, you know, were underrepresented, and he sacrificed a lot to make sure that they were taken care of. And so
can you describe that in any more detail for me? I mean, what kinds of things do you remember hearing and seeing?
oh, I just know that, you know, attorneys are expensive. And I know that some of his clients weren't able to pay for his services. And he volunteered in a lot of ways, time, money, and effort to make sure that they were, that justice was brought when they were done wrong. And so, yeah, I think that that's one piece of it. But also, my mother and father are from the South, and they both moved to Kansas City. My dad moved here for work. My mom moved here to marry my dad. And so I'm first generation Kansas Cityan, and they had always, when we would travel around the country, they'd always say, oh, this downtown's so much cooler than Kansas City's in Kansas. And I'm like, man, like, I'm from here. Like, you can't just bash my city because you're from different cities. And so there was always that. My cousins from St. Louis had this, you know, big competition with Kansas City. So I think those two things coupled together brought in or kind of led me to be an urbanist.
How did you originally start pursuing that? Was it always through music, or did you explore other avenues?
Actually, I kind of stumbled upon it. I tried to do music in college. I didn't like it, mostly because of the programs that I went to were too conservative. And so Gen Eds just forced me to take this class at UMKC called Urban Studies. And my professor, Jacob Wagner, kind of opened my eyes to a lot of that. And I basically loved everything that was about it. It was interdisciplinary. It talked about transportation, education, urban planning, all kind of different aspects, every aspect of a city. And that has a lot to do with, you know, demographics and geographic geography and all that. And so it just kind of lended itself to what I was interested in.
I have a clip from a rap you performed on the campaign trail with Mayor Sly James, and I'm going to play it. And then we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be not just an urbanist, but an urbanist whose main tools is music. Okay, let's hear it.
They say that Father Time is now on the side. From the middle of America, a diamond will shine. Who's the one that's willing to dig it down in the mine and bring the treasure to the people, every stone that he finds? As I sit back and witness my talent decline, see the genesis of Zion, the stars are aligned. But now the balance of time yields malice and crime. But the shadows allow my eyes to my rhyme to find. But hold up, where's the discussion? Our school district's spelling is sad. Nobody hears them like the hell in the cat. Nobody hears them. The media ignoring the children. The empty buildings, the storefronts teeming with villains, so many killings. The chillings are the essence where restroom headers are symbolic of things. I hold the keys to the city like the city hall janitors. Vote for Sly James, cause everybody's had enough. Yeah, I'ma vote for my man Sly James. Who's the one to bring change, Sly James? I'm the one to get it done, Sly James. Who can make the city one? Who you vote for?
So, not a subtle message.
Yeah. Pretty direct.
But, is it risky to align yourself so openly with a politician?
It's very risky. But, you know, life is very short as well. And so you just have to make the call sometimes. And I felt like Sly was probably the one that could bring about the most amount of change, just because I knew him personally as well, because we were family friends. But in addition, on top of that, I think the alternative was not as viable. And so it was important for me to engage an audience that wouldn't be engaged in local politics, because I felt like it was very important.
And I guess as part of that, then after the campaign is over and a politician is in office, do you feel sort of like you are partly like on the hook, you know, whatever happens here?
Yeah, there's that. But I mean, we're all human, and there's nothing I can do about that. So yeah, I think that's definitely one of the risks, the risks of aligning yourself so closely with a politician. But I think the difference is with local politics here in Kansas City that are quote unquote nonpartisan. I think it's safer to do that because you don't have to fumble through the gridlock of you know, parties.
Another thing, though, when you look at national politics and the way that various artists will sort of use their platform to let their positions be known, mm-hmm. a lot of times it's just by showing up and kind of being like, hey, I'm here, I like this person. But to compose an original song to be used on the campaign trail with the message that, like, you want people to vote for this candidate.
Totally.
That's a pretty significant level of effort. I mean, what inspires you to insert yourself on that level? You also have a streetcar song.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it works both ways. It's something that, you know, it's two birds and one stone. So on one hand, I'm engaging people in a new, fresh way that people wouldn't normally see in Kansas City. And I'm also gaining a reputation of being someone that's supportive of Kansas City local issues. And also, you know, I reap the benefits of that, you know, and I have to survive as an artist as well. And so it's just a win-win for me.
But having grown up with parents who are always pointing out how other cities might appear cooler.
Yeah.
Were you ever tempted to go to one of those places?
Oh, yeah, I was tempted. I lived in L.A. for a couple months, and I didn't like it. It was pretty much right after high school. I had a buddy, and we started a studio, and we were like, oh, let's move to L.A. and start a studio. And that was really, really green. That was really stupid of me. And
Wait, what was stupid about it?
Oh, just the idea that an 18-year-old can go out to L.A. and survive and open a studio. That is just not smart. So, yeah, there was that temptation. But, you know, when I was growing up, there was an inferiority complex that I'm not sure if my kids will have here in Kansas City, luckily. But there was definitely this Kansas City stinks, and like every city's better than KC. Even St. Louis was apparently better than Kansas City. I'm not sure if it is anymore.
A songwriter came to my school when I was growing up and had us write a song about Kansas City. And I remember like the chorus started with, and the kids in the class wrote this together, but it started with Kansas City, what a pity. That was the rhyme in the song.
Yeah.
I don't think that would happen now.
Yeah, I don't think so either. There are still some after effects of that inferiority complex. I mean, you still see shirts being made that's like cow tipping. And I mean, I just don't buy the cowtown thing anymore. I don't think we're there anymore. I think we're more of a cosmopolitan, small town feel, but big city.
Getting back to you as a musician, you go by the Phantom. Why is that?
I have always been one that appreciates, at my heart, I'm a shy person, at the core. I'm shy and I'm an introvert.
I don't believe you.
Yeah, I've re-socialized myself to not be. But I've always been one to want to stay behind the veil, and not to reference Game of Thrones, but stay behind the veil and just unleash something that was unexpected. And I think a phantom kind of embodies that. It's someone that's fluid. It's someone that, or something, or it, something that is able to move around freely and just surprise and just disappear again. And so I've always been attracted to that.
Is that related to the name of your band, which is the Fantastics with a PH?
Yes, that's right. The Fantastics, I mean, we came together as a band that basically, we started out just doing my songs, live versions of my solo songs. And so I just felt like it was natural to add a PH to the word fantastic. There was no other word to describe the band, in my opinion, was fantastic. Every time we perform, there's always somebody that was like, that was fantastic. And I'm like, yeah, cool, thanks, that is our name.
With being quote-unquote dance floor activators, I mean, do you find that challenging?
It is challenging, especially when people aren't imbibing. It is challenging, and that we love that challenge. We love it, especially when children are around. Whenever we can show them that there's local music that is danceable, that sounds like some stuff there on the radio, we love it.
Well, Kemet Coleman, with us from the Fantastics, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
The next opportunity to catch the Fantastics is tonight in Lawrence during the KU kickoff, which is a big party on Mass Street. But they've got lots of shows this month, including an appearance in the Crossroads Music Festival. Check out the band's website for all that information. They're fantasticswithaph.com. And you can listen back to everything that we talked about today, the play Men on Boats, the quixotic performance at the Block Building, and the Fantastics at kcur.org/centralstandard. That'll all be ready for you later today. Again, that's kcur.org/centralstandard. It's the weekend, but you can stay in touch with us all the time on Twitter. We're at kcurcst. And that brings this week to a wrap. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend. Up to Date is next. Do not miss it.